Hello, I'm Charlotte Armitage and this is Objects. In this episode I'm speaking to Councillor Graham Campbell. Graham was born in Jamaica and grew up in North London before moving to Scotland permanently in 2002. Graham is a Rastafarian veteran political campaigner and community activist who in May 2017 was elected as Glasgow City Council's and Scotland's first ever African Caribbean councillor. Graham has inspired me to be more curious about Scotland's hidden past. As a city councillor and a proud Scots Jamaican, Graham has shone a light on the role that Scottish people had in the slave trade and has campaigned for Glasgow to recognise and acknowledge its legacy of tobacco lords, sugar barons and cotton kings. As Graham has previously said, when you are part of the crime scene, you cannot let the evidence walk away. Graham, thank you so much for joining me on Objects.
Hello. Hello, Charlotte. How are you doing?
I'm sure many residents of Glasgow will know who you are, but for listeners across Scotland who maybe don't know who you are, can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Well, I say my name is Graham Campbell, Graham Michael Campbell, but I'm an Anglo-Jamaican Scot, in a nutshell, by considering myself probably Jamaican. If you ask me what nationality I am, I'm a Rastafarian. I've lived in Glasgow for 17 years, and I stayed here mainly because people are reasonably friendly and they've taken to me and they kept me here, basically. So it's all their fault. But I've been here a long time, and Glasgow's my home now, and I've lived in Jamaica, Canada, and mostly England until living here.
So you're well travelled. So we're obviously here to hear about your objects, which represent the different stages of care. But before we talked about your objects, I wanted to talk about the process before that and figure out how it was finding them for you. And was it easy? Did you know what it was from the initial conversation, or did you have to put a lot of thought into it?
I struggled to find objects that were related to my childhood, because like a lot of care experienced people during those days, and I'm 52 years old, so when I was around, it wasn't common that everybody had a camera. Even, you know, I was too poor to have a camera, and the family members who did had, maybe they had Polaroid, but they weren't around to record my memory, so there was nothing. I have absolutely no photographs of that period of time at all, not until I was a young adult, really. So I don't have anything like that. So I could easily have brought an empty photograph frame to symbolise that. But I think I knew I was going to bring bears. Bears, I knew I was going to bring. So one item I knew, but the others I really only just chose this afternoon. I wanted to be sure that they were the right things for before, during and after.
And how did you find the actual process going and trying to pinpoint stages of your life through objects?
Incredibly difficult, to be dead honest. Mainly because I've got stuff that represents my life now, but there really isn't any objects I have which represents that part of time in my life, because, well, you move house often. That's why I bought a suitcase, because it symbolises the fact that I moved house so many times, just before I was even taken into care fully, but with my mum being mentally ill and, you know, not being well supported at the time when she had two children on her own. We moved a lot because we kept having her not pay her bills and pay her rent and being evicted and then going to another house. That happened at least half a dozen times when I was young before going into care. So I remember living constantly in suitcases. And so the suitcase has been the major part of my early life. It's the fact of not, although we lived in the same area, we stayed in Islington in North London, but I remember a lot of the time visiting social services offices, benefits offices, and in those days they smoked everywhere, so the horrible laminated orange furniture that they used to have in 1970s offices, long before you were born. But it was, you knew you were in poverty because you were there, and everybody else wasn't, at least you thought so. So it was, I've had a contact with agencies and with officials for a large part of my life, from as long as I can really consciously remember, if I'm dead honest, from at least six I can remember first going to an office with my mum to get money for pay a bill or to have something to eat, and I remember going hungry, yes.
Yeah, so I think there you've just actually touched on
before care, and that brings us right into our first object. So you said that you struggled to find something. So what is your object? What did you decide to bring with you?
I figured that the suitcase was important to just bring that to symbolise it, but the objects inside was really the bear. I've got two bears. One of them is Lorelei Bear, and Lorelei is my bear, and she symbolises, I've had her for I think about 25 years, and I got her in Canada. I had a sort of surrogate mum in Canada when I was studying over there, and she looked after me, and she gave me her bear. So this bear is about 60 years old. But it symbolises the fact that I don't have any of the toys from my childhood, and it really wasn't until then I really, it occurred to me, I don't have any toys from my childhood at all. Because we moved, and also my mum being mentally ill tended to destroy the house several times, you know, with shouted voices and get angry with them. And, you know, she had schizophrenia, so it was, quite often she would destroy our toys. And I remember coming home from school one day and, she'd come home and destroyed all the toys she brought us for Christmas.
Wow.
Literally, physically dismantled. I had a really favourite clockwork rabbit thing which my dad had got me, and she destroyed it and then set fire to the house and we were homeless for a few weeks because we had to be moved until they redecorated the house.
So it's funny that you laugh at that, because it's almost like it's not at all funny, but it's actually really quite sad. But that's almost like just a coping mechanism, you know,
for sure. But it wasn't unusual. I had knew no better. Because that was my mum, and when she was lucid and, and okay, she was lovely. She was a great parent. She was really funny. She was a lovely soul in lots of ways. But when she was upset, anxious, or going through a phase, she was a real monster. And when she was in that mode, you couldn't brook with that. And, so we went right back to the start. And quite often, the suitcase played a thing in our lives because, you know, she was constantly packed, waiting for a better move to a better house. Oh, and she would always, part of her thing was, oh, we're going to move. We're moving next week. Yes, we're moving. Yes, we're moving. And we weren't moving, but she would make it happen, she thought, by setting our place alight or, whatever. So it was, that was why I was in the end taking the care. My brother went first. And my brother is autistic and quite severe on the spectrum. And he had to go into care first because it was impossible to, in those days in the 70s, they did not have proper provision in schools or in social care or whatever. And he had to leave the family early. And so that really destroyed the family because he went to Cambridgeshire because there was no provision in London in those days. And so not long after, about a year after, I went into care. But I'd been a young carer from about the age of 6. So I remember having to do breakfast for myself and my brother, and bath my brother. And I didn't know any different. I didn't hate doing it. It was just what we had to do when my mother wasn't up for it. When she was great. So the bears kind of symbolise that. And I bought two bears. And the other bear is actually my mum's bear. This is Charlie. And Charlie was, when my mum was suffering from dementia, she died 2 years ago. And when she was going through dementia, this was her bear for the last 2 years of her life. And, she looked after Charlie really well. And it was kind of weird that my mum had a bear and never gave me a bear. I had to get my bear through anywhere else. But, that's one. It's the main object I've kept from her things. It's just that, really.
It's funny that you didn't have a bear, but this one's actually connected to your childhood so massively. So much so that you bring it for your first object to represent before care. You've already sort of touched on you going into care there in that object, and I think that's a good way to go into your second object, which would represent during care for you. So you said your brother went into care first. What was that like?
I knew that my mum couldn't cope, and I knew that I couldn't cope. So I knew it wasn't the worst thing for him. But the only trouble was having to travel so far and to go there and to have to rely on the social workers to get you up there and everything. So you were, and every time you went, you could see his distress in us leaving and then us not being able to do it as often as we liked. But in those days, social workers were under a bit less pressure than they are now in terms of caseload. Our social workers had time to actually go up there with us and, you know, have a budget to do these things with. And I remember, you know, by the time I got into care, we had our own social workers. You know, all three of us had our own. You know, that wouldn't happen now. You'd have one for the whole three of you. So we each had our own interests looked after in our own different ways. And, you know, they did their best. I wouldn't say that we had a bad experience of it, but the downside was having to go into care, into actual care. And I went into care in, first remember going into it in maybe 1978, maybe slightly earlier, maybe 77, before I was left primary school. And I remember being in a house full of lots of older kids. It was a bit like a youth club, but with social workers living in, you know, but you were the youngest kid in it. And, you know, that was quite weird. It was a bit intimidating. But we only stayed for a few nights and then we went home again. And so I realised that my mum wasn't disappeared. My mum would go on things like bus rides where she would just go on a bus for 3 days and then to return. I remember very clearly the first time we were taken to a police station to be taken into care. And it was when my mum took us to stand outside a library and she told us to stand there until she came back. And we were there for about 2 hours before some gentleman came to take us to a police station, and that was how we were taken to care the first time. So I got there and... Yeah, I remember the distress, of course you do. You know, your feeling of abandonment lasts with you a very long time. And mine lasted for a very long time indeed.
Yeah. So what was your object for care? What did you bring with you that represented your time in care?
That was difficult. I really couldn't really encapsulate that in an object, to be honest. But I suppose the survival element of it, which is why I brought the elephant, because this wee elephant fella, it's just for you, the benefit of your listeners there, it's one of a pair of ones that you put on the end of a bookshelf, and one hangs off the bookshelf and the other stacks up the books. So I've bought the one that isn't broken, which is this one. But elephants is my favourite animal, so always I've been, and I've got lots of elephant shirts. It's a thing that people do when they go to Africa or India, they buy me elephant shirts, so I've got loads of them. But the elephant kind of symbolises sort of me, really. It symbolises that you don't forget stuff, obviously, but also that you keep on marching through the jungle. This whatever rubbish is thrown in your way, you keep on your journey, because your journey's important, and you keep on plodding on, you keep on keeping on. Your survival instinct is important, that whatever life throws at you, it's important to stay like they are. I mean, they are obviously massively brilliant animals in that they grieve for their dead, they live in communities and families, they shed tears, you know, they're strong as hell, but they're soft as mush inside, and that's kind of what I'm like. So I very much identify with them, and if we were to lose them, I would feel very angry about it. So yes, this symbolises me in care, because I think I had to develop a very thick skin, as they do, standing up to insults, various bits of, you know, oppression, whether it's from other kids who are suffering with their own problems, or racism, whatever it was. You know, it was quite old school in them days. It was one of the reasons why black children in the 70s and 80s stayed in care a bit longer than average, because foster carers wouldn't take us in. So there was quite a lot of discussion when I was in care about whether it was appropriate to place black youngsters with white families, who didn't have a cultural understanding of where we came from. I'm still of the view, and I'm quite old school in this, that actually that's important, that somebody is culturally appropriately understanding of the culture that somebody comes from. And in these days, you know, even in those days, you know, it wasn't unusual for you to go back to your family. It wasn't permanent in any way. So if you know that there's a possibility of you going back to your family, it's important to keep the connection so that you're not as distressed as you might be. You know, so I always kept my contact with my mum. And it's funny that I remember that I met one of my half-sisters for the first time during care. I mean, if I hadn't been in care, possibly it wouldn't have mattered. But it was funny that at that moment when, you know, my separated family had decided to try and help my mum, but not really helped her very much, that was when my dad introduced me to my half-sister. And that was interesting to go through that experience. And you know, I lived with various members of my family. I mean, I should explain. I went to a school in Suffolk, which was for kids from inner city London to go out and get a sort of grammar type school education. It was called the Poor Man's Eden. And it closed in 1987, I was thereabouts. But it happened for about 4 years. It took inner city kids through an 11 plus exam, and we got the benefits of a boarding school education, but not paid for. It was done as a comprehensive education thing. And I resented it at the time, but it was the one thing that was probably consistent during this period in care. So I went to the same school, I got a good education, I managed to get out of my area that was causing us harm, you know, and all the problems it was causing us. And if I'd stayed at the school I'd gone to, I would undoubtedly have got into all the bad habits that a lot of my peers did who stayed in the area. So I was quite lucky, and I realised that many years afterwards. But at the time it was a thing, you know, so I had the one solid home was at school, hence the backpack. Every term we'd go home, and sometimes I wouldn't know what house I would go to. I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know which family member, or if I was at foster parents, temporary foster parents. And, you know, there was one period of time when I was fostered for quite a while, for about a year and a half. And I remember I was in a house. It was a madhouse, really. It was an Irish young woman who was married to an Indian lawyer. He was slightly older than her, and they had a four-year-old daughter. But they were looking after a large house with six teenage young people of varying degrees of distress or abandonment and issues. And I lived in this house, and what tipped it over the edge, I mean, they were just nowhere near equipped for this, but because they had a large house, they were prepared to do it. I mean, they were desperate, really, I suppose, the social services in those days. They needed people to do this. But although it was chaotic, it led to a crisis when one of the kids in the home decided to have a dog, and this dog was a pointer. And, you know, yeah, we're like every other family. Yeah, we might be weird. We might be a bunch of Nigerian sisters, two modettes, one urban DJ, me, and this Anglo-Irish Indian couple, and their daughter, who likes to draw on your records and make crayon-y drawings on them and, you know, make stepping stony games out of them. So this was this house, and then, but one day the dog did its thing on the carpet, and we were woken up early one morning, 4 days before Christmas, and told to ring our social workers by the mum. And it turned out they split up, they divorced, and we then moved in with complete strangers 4 days before Christmas, and that's what happened to us. And then after that, I lived at, I think I counted it at once, I think it was about 12 or 13 different households I lived in during the course of, until I left care and went back to my mum.
Wow. So there's obviously a lot happened in that period. And what do you think the impact of this period has had on you throughout your life and now where you are?
I would say that it undoubtedly distressed me. There's no question about that. I mean, I coped with it. I mean, you develop coping mechanisms. As I say, the elephant, you develop the strong surface skin where you don't get upset too much. You don't get knocked back too much. I mean, I did well at school, and you know, I enjoyed my time at school. Thank goodness school was there. But The downside of it is that you can't relate normally in a relationship sense, because you don't see what a loving relationship is like in a normal sense, because you don't have normal that everybody else has. You have your normal, which is totally different. So you try and deal with that. And I think the impact it's had on me is that there's a certain amount of growing up I had to do myself without nurturing from somebody else. So I had to nurture myself. And there's only so much you can do on your own. You really need adults that you trust to do that with. And I was lucky that once I got into my teens and early 20s, I met some very good people who were thankfully, emotionally literate enough, studying their Freud and their Marx and their feminist writers and everything, to help me work through what were the psychodynamics of my mum's trauma, you know, because I think what allowed me to cope with it was working out that my mum was a victim. And once you work out that the person that's caused you the distress is actually themselves a victim and has been massively neglected in their lives, it helped me to rationalise, well, actually, I feel sympathy for her, I actually feel solidarity for her, and that while I may have suffered, I didn't suffer as much as she did.
Mm.
And, you know, that was how I kind of worked it out. So I managed to forgive her in lots of ways, you know, and I wanted to look after her, and I went home as an adult, but I chose to do that rather than go to independent, supported living, as you are entitled to do, and mm-hmm. were those in those days. And I made a big mistake. I think one of the things it's impacted is I had an emotional immaturity. You kind of have a very good sense of, you know, boundaries, I suppose. You are very cautious about letting people in, but at other times you're overly abandoning and opening up to people.
Mm.
I'm opening up to you now on this podcast, you know, I'm telling you all. But I think I've worked out that for the first 10 years after care, I probably was way too open and speaking out about my hurt. I wore my hurt on my sleeve. And it was great that I was emotionally literate about it, but most people couldn't cope with this. Most people are not equipped to deal with, not having supportive parents in your life, not having these basic nurturing things, not being shown how to wash yourself properly and things like that, and having to learn that through school. If I hadn't had school, I would never have learned how to make a bed, make toast, or do a hospital corner, which I still do to this day. You know, these, thank goodness I had school to teach me that, because if I wouldn't have learned it otherwise. And learning basic respect for other people's needs. You know, I had a younger brother, so that it made me react very differently when I was in school. Bullying was just a thing I just couldn't do. If you have a younger brother, how can you bully someone mm-hmm. smaller than you? Just don't get that. That's just mad to me. So, negotiating that, I think it's had a lasting impact in the sense that I feel a strong sense of injustice and fairness, and I won't brook unfairness, and I won't participate in unfairness either. That's the other thing it's given me. If you're in a children's home, you have a very strong sense of group think mm-hmm. and protecting all of yours. You know, you're a team together mm-hmm. against everybody else. And, you know, I still got friends from my original children's home from 1981. You know, those friendships have lasted an incredibly long time.
That's fantastic to hear that, actually. You just said it there for me. It's been an incredibly long time. You're now obviously quite far away from when you were in care, and it's aftercare. So for your third and final object, which represents aftercare in quite a long period of time, what was your object? What did you bring with you?
I could have brought loads of different things. But I suppose I've got to use it to symbolise who I've become and what I am now. And I have this thing I call my chain of office, but basically, to describe it to you, it's a chain of wooden beads on a string with four Africas on it, which is a sort of, I've got a red, gold and green Africa, which is primary colours of Iration, which is to do with Rastafarianism, mm-hmm. and Ethiopia, the Ethiopian country, that's their national colours, but the colours symbolise green for the land of Africa, yellow, gold for the wealth, and red for the blood of the people. So it symbolises the African continent. So I have another Africa here, and another Africa which represents the animals. I've got a gold one. And the four Africas, you know, which represent the people of the continent itself, the African people in the diaspora, and the African people of the Caribbean. I'm a Caribbean African. And so that's why I've got that. So the chain was actually given to me by one of my colleagues, which is Bailey Christie. And that Christie is my good friend, and I'm sort of godfather to one, her daughter, who's half Jamaican. Right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, she's my partner's best friend, and she was elected the same time as I was. But she gave me that as one of her presents for me from Jamaica, and so I've worn it ever since I've been in office. And I suppose it symbolises the fact that I'm a Rastafarian, symbolises that I have an important duty, but it also symbolises that I've triumphed, you know, but also I am a survivor, and I'm a survivor in a number of different ways. I'm a survivor of slavery. I've campaigned a lot around the slavery legacy and what that means to Glasgow. You know, I've been quite instrumental in pushing that and making sure that we say something about it. So I've been doing that for about 10, 12 years, and did a play about it during the Commonwealth Games. I'm on like a museum committee at the moment trying to work out how we market in our things. So I consider myself quite lucky to be here. I'm a survivor of that. Therefore, you know, given what happened in slavery, I could easily not exist at all. So I have a responsibility of having my ancestors survive all that trauma for centuries of oppression, and then my own experience of this. I have a duty of care to just not forget my ancestors, who they were, where they came from, and that they have only existed in order that I can be here. And I feel a very strong sense of that. And so I owe it to my family, my mum, anybody who's been through the care experience, to do what I can to use my power to make it plain that the council has to do its job, that the authorities have to do a good job as corporate parents. I'm very passionate about that, and I've used my influence where I can to question how we do things and to resource the things I think we should resource, because it's massively crucial. I always say this when I'm on committees. If you had a parent who owned a massive company that employs nearly 30,000 people or whatever, and they had all these various departments, you know, see what Donald Trump does, right? He owns all those businesses. And what does he do? Is he makes his daughter chief exec of this, his son's chief exec of that. They run the business with him. Well, we've got all these children who are our children. We're the corporate parent. Our kids in care should, in fact, be the most advantaged people. They are the ones who should have the most opportunities, the most access to our potential employment chances and opportunities and education endowments. We're the parent, therefore we should look after our kids. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at it that it shouldn't be the case as it is now, where the kid in care is the least likely to go to university. We're doing lots to challenge that. It's much improved now. The kids in care, because of the programs we're doing at school, through things like MCR pathways and other programs, we're managing to get majority of kids in care now getting their five hires or more. But we've got long. There's still a big gap. You know, our kids should have the biggest advantage possible because they are our kids. So I want it to get to that point.
And did you always know that you wanted to be like a councillor or involved in politics? Was that always your path when you left care? Did you know that?
I've always been politically active. I've been politically active, I think, since about 15. First, there was a reggae Rastafarian, I suppose. That's kind of really how I discovered myself. Then, as an anti-nuclear activist, I joined CND when I was about 16. Went on all the big anti-nuclear demos in those days. I took part in the miners' strike, fed miners in Kent and Yorkshire, so I went on picket lines there. I got involved in the Wapping dispute, which was the big printers' dispute at the Sun, when Murdoch beat the unions, and I was with the unions, and so I was there facing trucks. So I had a very early lesson in class solidarity, and most of my cousins and slightly older cousins had experienced police oppression through stop and search, and you know, so that was my experience of life growing up. Racism on the way to school, National Front, newspaper sellers selling stuff, and Enoch Powell's speech influencing them. So we grew up with that environment. So politics couldn't but be part of your life when that's your environment. So I see you can't avoid politics, but the question then is how sovereign you are in the process of being politically active. And I've always been a sort of community activist, a movement activist, and the politics, the revolutionary politics came that way. So when somebody came to me on the street and said, right, we are going to overthrow Margaret Thatcher, we should have a general strike, comrade. And that's how I said it. And we were collecting tins for the miners and stuff like that. And I said, yeah, I'll have some of that. So I went to Blackpool, went to the conference, and you know, duly signed up, and then spent a lot of time waiting for the revolution around the corner, which then didn't happen. Mm-hmm. You know, so I remember youth unemployment in a mass way that as it was in the 1980s, and it affected my life, and I probably was less well equipped to deal with it because, you know, I didn't have parents there nurturing me and pushing me on to use the brain I had to go to university when I should have done, or go to A levels and do that properly. I think if I had been a different family, I would have probably done that. I would have gone on. The legacy I had of that was by the time I worked out that it was the right thing to do to go to uni, they introduced fees, didn't they? And that kind of put the kibosh on that. That happened about a year into it. I did my first year fine, no problem. Got sailed through it. The moment the finance element came into it, that really screwed up my life. I became homeless and had my breakdown, and then had to sort of survive that by just leaving the country. So I left the country, did my travelling, and that probably helped me, I would say. So yeah, I came back eventually, sorted out my life, and worked out a way to do these things. So, you know, there's no doubt that the care experience still affects me now. It affects you in relationships, it affects you in the power you have with other people and how they perceive you. But I'm always very insistent that I can do stuff that other people can do, and because I've got the brain. Mm-hmm. I'm lucky I have a brain, I can use it. You know, and you know, perhaps because I'm quite posh, you know, I had this boarding school education, it taught you received pronunciation, because I know this. People maybe don't perceive my class correctly. Because you speak the language and accent of power.
Yeah.
So I think what people in care are good at, is they're good at playing a role. They're good at hiding their hurt from things. They're good at shielding themselves from these things. We have to be, because these are our survival and coping mechanisms. But politics allows you to sort of, you know, being politically active always allowed me to sort of obfuscate that. You know, you could objectify all the oppression and hurt that you have in your own directing in your own family life by rationalising it, explaining where it comes from. Okay, these institutions are responsible for why my family fell apart, why the racism they experienced gave them psychological damage, why the benefit system treated them the way they did, and you see that happening again now. Politics allows you to rationalise that and try and target your anger and frustration with it, and that, I think that's what it allowed me to do. It allowed me to target it in a way that wasn't antisocial and wasn't negative for myself and not criminal action, you know, criminally based. I could have gone down that path quite easily. Lots of friends of mine who were in primary school did, and don't know what they'd done with their lives, but I certainly wouldn't be able to have done what I've done without the political activism. It did help me to survive.
And you now find your role as a corporate parent, your care experience and a corporate parent. How do you find that? That must be so enlightening, because you know your own experience, but you're a corporate parent.
Yes. So I'm very careful. I mean, I hummed and hawed about whether I should do this, because I thought, this is quite confessional, right? Mm-hmm. And up till now, nobody would have known that I was in care. They will know now, and they probably will change their perspective or opinion of me because of it. They may take me less seriously. And that's a calculated risk. Okay, but that's what I'm going to do. But it gives me a unique insight, I suppose, because I'm not going to ask care experienced young people to emotionally lay their ground out. I actually think that's not necessarily the healthy. You know, they shouldn't have to do that to make us interested in what happens. It should not be a sort of... There's a kind of... it's the equivalent of third world aid kind of poverty porn, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't like those adverts that you have. Give £3 and here's a poor starving African child. Mm-hmm. And it's bad for the, you know, the way they put Africa across, because everybody thinks that all of Africa's like that. But it's the same with kids in care, in my view. I don't want to parade their emotions in public as a way of bringing in attention to the issue. I think it's actually really important that we just simply do our job, which is to remove the barriers that are potentially in their way and to create opportunities for them. You know, so we make sure we provide the housing, we make the wraparound care, we provide the emotional aftercare, you know, the psychological counselling that might be necessary, whatever it is that person needs. It needs to be tailored to them, and they need to have, be more sovereign in emotionally and practically in their lives. And I don't really want to exploit their emotions and their feelings around that. I want them to own them and be in control of what happens to them, because that's the biggest thing I think I felt was the complete lack of control over everything. Even when I left, you know, I wasn't in control. Even though I was a carer, I was responsible for my mum, but my mum was the adult. My mum was the person who was the benefit recipient, and I had to be a subordinate person and not be financially independent in my own right, because that's the way it was in those days. It's that autonomy, it's that independence that people want and crave for, but they also need support and nurturing. And, you know, in any normal family today, you can see now that, you know, in my generation, people used to leave home quite early. Mm. Now they have to stay quite late because of the way, you know, the way jobs and hours are, that people actually haven't got enough money to buy.
I think it's
homes.
Like 26 is that.
Yeah, so it's gone up massively. You know, in my age, it was, you know, 18 to 20 you'd leave home by. So the fact that it's gone up means that you still need your parents well into your adulthood. If that's true in a supposedly normal, quotes unquote, family, what's it going to be like for kids in care? So quite rightly, that care has to go into when they're nearly 30. Yeah, why not? It needs to be, because that's what it would be like if it was a family. So I'm looking to see, you know, I'm quite pleased with the Scottish Government's stance on this, that it understands that it's a long-term commitment,
mm-hmm.
not just for the period of crisis. It's actually, the crisis has an emotional after-ripple long after the crisis period over. I'm 52. I'm still affected by it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you've spoken off a lot there about what care experience people need. See, reflecting back, you've just gone from before, during and after care. Mm. Reflecting back throughout all those periods, is there anything that you think you needed that you wish you had in those stages and all stages?
That's been probably the most negative impact it's had on me. It's probably that my decision not to have children. Because I didn't see a normal family life around me, and I saw lots of dysfunctional families within my wider family, you know, lots of divorce, lots of separation, lots of issues, which I'm not going to go into here because I don't have their permission to talk about it. But let's say that I did not have a good example set to me, and therefore I felt I did not want to continue and carry this on into the next generation. So now I probably regret it. I regret not doing so. And it's one of my probably enduring regrets that had I had more counselling earlier on in my life, I possibly would have been more emotionally stable to have done that now with my life. I would have children now. So that's been the most negative impact on it. Positively, yeah, I suppose I would say I've Yes, it's given me an insight into other people's feelings and oppressions, and you know, it's made me feel a strong sense of solidarity with, even if people don't have my life experience, I can identify, because I understand what it feels like to be disempowered. Therefore, I understand what empowerment feels like and why it's essential. I don't want the power. I actually want to hand over that power and empower other people so that they're sovereign. Mm. To me, I think that's a key moral principle of mine. I want people to be sovereign and control their lives. That requires us to give them the respect that's due, to give them the room that they need, and to, where it's appropriate, get out of their way, but where it's appropriate also to give them the support.
So just a minute ago you spoke about not really talking about your care experience. Now you've been on Objects and you've opened up to me, as you said before, what would you say to other care experience people who might be interested in being a guest of Objects now that you've just done it?
I think we must remove the stigma. And I've decided to make a calculated risk that by talking about it, I'm helping to reduce any stigmatizing sort of thinkings about that. The fact that somebody like me, with all the millions of statistics which should have said that I would not be here, but I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it's a good thing that I'm here. And the fact that I can be, and that you can go from being in care, have a completely collapsed family life, have all the issues you might have, but you can, you know, that's the corner, you can rise above it, but you can rise with it and through it, I would say. That you can achieve things that that are important to you. Don't let those things get in the way. Have confidence in yourself. You can do it.
Graham Campbell, thank you for coming on to Objects and sharing your Objects. It's been a pleasure to listen to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.